All right, so I think we're live now. Yeah, Derek, here's another Pop the Left podcast and video stream. People who watch all of our videos will notice that I haven't changed my shirt since yesterday. Welcome. We're going to be talking about a lecture that Chris Cotrone gave, I guess, for a Platypus meeting. I'm not sure where. I forget.
So I wanted to say a couple of things in introduction before I give a presentation. A long-standing point of dialogue between Platypus and the Communist Party of Great Britain, CPGB, has been over the significance of critical theory going back to Lukács and Karl Korsch from the early 20th century to the practice of ostensible Marxism today. And essentially, Mike McNair's perspective, and hopefully you guys had the chance to read the articles that we circulated ahead of this event, is that theoretical or philosophical agreement is a bad basis for political organization. Because it gives rise to sectarianism and it gives rise to authoritarian politics within these organizations. On that, I would largely agree. But anyway, he saw Platypus as a new tendency and a new organization on the left as going down the same mistaken highway. More recently, James Turley of the CPGB, in early 2013, published an article called The Antinomies of Georg Lukács, and that prompted a series of exchanges, including myself and a guy, Lawrence Parker, who's a member of another Marxist tendency in the United Kingdom, arguing over the legacy of Lukács. And then belatedly, Mike McNair last November, in the article, The Philosophy Trap, followed up on that and responded to Parker and my own assertion that what McNair was saying about Lukács being an ultra-leftist, etc., and following history of Bolshevism, history of the left of the Second International in a particular way, what we pointed out was that, in fact, what Lukács and Korsch were both doing at the time was responding to Lenin's critique of ultra-leftism, left-wing communism, and infantile disorder, and that they were self-correcting, in fact. And so that's what occasioned Mike McNair to follow up with the philosophy trap.
So this is a very interesting lecture that Cotrone gave. I have listened to or watched that lecture more than once. I think a couple of years ago I stumbled upon it and listened to it. And it's so dense, filled with so many different historical moments and thinkers that I keep coming back to it. And I'm not sure to what extent I agree with Cotrone's ultimate point. But before we jump into what Cotrone's point is, maybe I give you an opportunity to kind of fill in what you find to be the background of the debate and to put this in context for people who are listening and watching.
So there's a couple of issues that you have to deal with when you deal with Lukács. The CPGB was a split from a ostensibly Marxist-Leninist party, the CPGB, and I think it's now called the CPGBML. There's a lot of communist parties in Britain and Great Britain, though, so it can be kind of confusing. Mike McNair, who's an Oxford Don, kind of a Leninist who critiques Lenin on Leninist grounds. I wrote a book called Revolutionary Strategy, I believe in the early aughts, that really caught on about like 5 years ago. And when it caught on across the board. Like you'll meet Marxist-Leninists who like it. Jacobin writers like it, etc. And one of the things they're concerned about is the sort of dogmatism and sectarianism of the Trotskyist and further less communist, Marxist humanist left, but they're also concerned about critiquing official communism. Lukács is important because Lukács is often seen as the voice of, you know, Hegelian Marxism in the context of an actual Soviet state as opposed to Western Marxism. He's sort of an in-between figure. Mm-hmm. And history and class consciousness, you know, develops a whole lot of different ideas. One that I think Turley picks up on that you and I have discussed about, and even Lukács condemns himself for, is the fact that his focus on methodology as expressed in the movement of the working class masses mm-hmm. is economistic. One of the reasons why it's assumed that he did this, though, is to...
When you say economistic, just to be clear, you mean what? Because there's a couple of different charges of, like, economism. One would be, like, if you're a Bernsteinian, you would be an economistic because you would think that the economy, the capitalist economy, can be worked out, that it can be perfected.
Okay.
You know, that's the one kind of economism, but that's not what you're talking about, right?
No, I'm talking about
like what people would charge Heinrich Grossman of being.
Right. Or, you know, people who would even charge maybe like Lenin uses his charge against a lot of left communists that they are economistic in the sense that they assume that the economic movement of the working class alone will be the foreground of the revolution. I'm not even sure it's necessarily a bad thing, but we talked about it when we talked about Taylorism.
Right. So the economic movement of the working class should be thought of as the struggles that the economy will force the working class to engage in will lead to revolution, right? That's the economy. That's like the battle would be for wages or for worker, for safety, you know,
right.
Safe work conditions or against child labor. And that the economy pushes the capitalists to create worse working conditions and to lower wages, and the working class will struggle against that. And the thought of someone who's an economistic Marxist is that that alone will produce a revolution.
Correct.
Right.
And I think that's actually maybe a fair charge. Another thing that he wants to do is to prove that Hegelian methodology from the standpoint of a totality in the Hegelian sense.
It's a fair charge of Lukács. You're saying that he thinks that alone will produce?
No. I think it's fair charge that he is trying to work that out.
Okay.
And that some of his contentions do come from sources that are beyond just Marx. Turley does a pretty good job of saying that Luxembourg, you know, Luxembourg's movementism, George Sorelian's myth of the general strike and the animating myth of the working class
mm-hmm.
as a you know, way to clarify and politicize the consciousness, have an effect on the way Lukács is framing things. Whether or not you think that's actually classical Marxism is a different thing. One of the things I noticed about Catrone's reading is Catrone, while he is frustrated with Lukács's denouncement of his Hegelian methodology and why he ended up Taylorist, and he points out that this is probably to reconcile himself to the formal Communist Party, which I think is also true. It's hard to prove someone's intention, but it seems like what was going on there. Catrone is interested in kind of vindicating the Hegelian historical read of the Marxist project and not just the economic read.
In subordinating theory to practice, McNair loses sight of the potential critical role that theory can play in political practice, specifically the task of consciousness of history in the struggle for transforming society in an emancipatory direction. A certain relation of theory to practice is a matter specific to the modern era, I would argue, and moreover a problem specific to the era of capitalism, that is, after the Industrial Revolution, the emergence of the modern proletarianized working class and its struggle for socialism, and the crisis of bourgeois social relations and thus of consciousness of society that this entails. Critical theory recognizes that the role of theory in the attempt to transform society is not to justify or legitimate or provide normative sanction, not to rationalize what is happening anyway, but rather to critique, to explore conditions of possibility for change. The role of such critical theory is not to describe how things are, but rather how they might become, how things could and should be, but are not yet. The political distinction, then, would be not over the description of reality, but rather the question of what can and should be changed, and over the direction of that change. Hence, critical theory as such goes beyond the distinction of analysis from description. People, you know, talk about descriptive theory versus analytic theory. Critical theory goes beyond that distinction. The issue is not theoretical analysis proper to practical matters, but beyond that, and of course incorporating this, the issue of transforming practices, and of doing so with active agency and subjective recognition, as opposed to merely experiencing changed practice as something that has already happened.
One of the frustrating things about Cotron's argument, and what I like about the speech, the kind of teach-in that he did, that I hope we link in this, that I don't like about the polemics he did, which are often like a page in response to like 20-page, 30-page articles, is that in the polemics, he'll often make an assertion and like a characterization of a person and just move on. Like, you know, he'll talk about Turley's Althusserianism and say he's like influenced by Lacanian postmodernism and, you know, go. Whereas in that teach-in, he really expounds out the logic for it. But I will say there's still a tendency not to explain the mechanism of what's being talked about, just that something is being talked about in that. You know, for example, when we're talking about like the transition from, you know, early capital to industrial capital to like monopolistic capitalism around the time of Lukács, which Cotron thinks is very important for the interpretation of this text, the mechanism of that difference isn't really articulated.
Cotron is interested in defending the platypus understanding of history or their historical read of Marxism or Marxism as a philosophy of history or maybe as a science of history, depending on what you mean by science. I think that's true. Without some sort of understanding of political economy or of the economy, let's just say economic categories, and what they in the way that capitalism expands and contracts, you're not going to be able to have an understanding of what's driving the historical development. And even if you want to call it a regression, you're not going to be able to determine what's driving the regression. And I don't think that Cotron truly escapes economic assumptions or an economistic read of history, if he's to be taken to be as coherent as I sometimes take him to be.
Without stating the mechanism of regression, it seems like what I would like to call a typological fix. Like it's a type that explains something like why the revolution didn't happen, but you don't say what exactly the mechanism of regression is. Is it monopoly capital? Is it labor aristocracy? Is it over-reification? Is it decadence theory? Is it real subsumption? You know, basically, regression is a stand-in for the proletarian revolution did not happen.
Right.
Capitalism seems overripe. It is starting to go back in the prior conditions like Marx described in De Bruyère in France. So, you know, it's not from Marx in some degree, but Marx doesn't really talk about it as a category type, the way it is used in later Marxist thinkers and particularly in Platypus. I mean, it's a keystone of understanding Platypus's interest in the left's decadence and its failure and its, you know, undead deadness.
I tend to think that what's being described is more of an impasse rather than a regression. Mm-hmm. So like a interregnum that's lasting for quite a long time as we fail repeatedly in different ways, rather than having reached a point and then drifting back. Now, maybe we forget certain things that we should have remembered from previous attempts, but I do admit that this, what I'm describing, is rather linear. And we need to, we'll probably get into like the difference between a linear progressive understanding of history and a dialectical one. The video I recently put out about conservative socialists or socialist conservatives, where I'm talking about the revisionism debate of the 1890s still having an influence on us debate today, is something that I see in this debate between Mike McNair and Catrone, but not directly between them, but you know, between Luxembourg and Lenin, and so on. And it comes down to, I think, how do we conceive of a movement, a political movement, that can get beyond the conditions of possibility that develop it? Because the conditions of possibility, in my mind, those are the economic relations of a society. Mm-hmm. And you're trying to, it's an old, we've framed this in different ways, but it's becoming more concrete as we move on through the years here. How do you develop a political movement that can change its own conditions of possibility?
Right. I mean, and Catrone, actually, one point that Catrone makes that I think is very good in Nota Bene, which is his response to Turley's response, to his response, mm-hmm. That led to that teaching. Turley accuses Catrone of being historically relativistic by ignoring the context of Lukács' life and just focusing on the ideas that emerged in history and class consciousness and its relationship to Hegel. Mm-hmm. To which Catrone says the following: at stake here is not historical revisionism, but rather the dialectics of history. Was Marxism historically subject to self-contradiction? Turley appears to dismiss this possibility, where this was Lukács' central concern in history and class consciousness. Like many readers, Turley sunders two pages of Lukács' title, History and Class Consciousness, rather than regarding their intrinsic interrelation for Marxists. Class consciousness is a consciousness of history, especially of its dialectical contradictions. Marxism was part of the history it sought to understand and change.
The way in which Marxism could be self-contradictory, I think primarily revolves around the role of political authority and self-organization.
Right. And I think Catrone, even though he never says it this way, and again, I'm reading into him, so this could be wrong, is actually pointing out that there are historical conditions. I mean, the emergence of actual political states, the seeming developments in the party, the different ways theories of monopoly capital played out, depending on where you were in relationship to the Soviet Union and what you thought businesses could do, that all these things actually had historical, material. He's often called me a vulgar materialist, though, so, you know, but he would say historical emergent factors that push the theories in ways that were, you know, frankly, impasses that you couldn't get through and seem to contradict some of the key points of Marx. And the way to intervene, you know, from Platypus's standpoint, which is to intervene kind of to point out these contradictions in their historical framework so that you can seize on them politically. One of the things that got me to leave Platypus just before this was the Endnotes Collective critique of Platypus focusing on the political ideas and philosophies of the left, even though Catrone is very quick to point out the difference between a philosophical and a political critique. If you go through all this, that's
That in this lecture too, that there's the difference, but go on.
Yeah. That you will notice that like the material conditions of the working class are not really what's driving these changes. It's it's kind of your relationship to a teleological perspective of the idea, although he would say a dialectical teleology as opposed to an Aristotelian one, I guess. You know, we have our subject of, we've been tasked by history to do a specific thing. And that thing is to bring about the abolition of a bunch of class antagonists, so true history can begin. But you and I have, we talked about this piece is that it's often hard to know where, like, exactly why these things happen from the way it's articulated. Like, what is driving these changes? What about industrial capital really changing?
Well, there are two problems. I mean, what I would say is that there's the revisionist dispute of the 1890s, and then there's the crisis of World War I. And there's also the time in between. In other words, we might say that there are three phases to this, that there's, upon Engels' death, there's Bernstein saying, well, you know, I've been having some thoughts, and maybe these thoughts don't amount to anything, but I'm going to offer them anyway. You know, because basically now that Engels is dead, he can feel uninhibited to speak his mind. And he's saying, well, you know, the workers' movement, and by which he meant the British workers' movement, has developed to such a point that perhaps revolution a la 1848 has been rendered obsolete. In other words, that we won't expect socialism to proceed in a place like Great Britain, in the advanced capitalist countries, maybe in a place like Germany, but hopefully not. But in a place like Britain, we can't expect a political collapse and revolution. In Germany, maybe, because Germany is still controlled by, you know, feudalism, the Prussian state, etc. But in Britain, we can't expect an 1848 revolution. In other words, we're not going to have a crisis in Britain akin to the crisis of Chartism of the 1830s, 1840s, on which Marx based his perspectives. And he's basically saying, well, and so what does this say? And he's, you know, saying that socialism is developing within capitalism, that there's an evolution of capitalism into socialism. And then, you know, Kautsky, Rosa Luxemburg, Plekhanov have to say, well, no, wait a second. In fact, what's happening is not the evolution of socialism, that of capitalism, but rather a deepening crisis of capitalism. In other words, what looks like the gains of the working class are actually a deepening crisis of capitalism.
And I think that the regression doesn't come out of the economic crisis alone, but it comes out of the way in which the socialist proletariat tries to respond, and after being defeated, let's say after World War One, maybe now the social, there is no force for progress after these crises. So all you get are regressions. That's the story I'm hearing from Catrone,
right? But you're not given either a clear.
I don't know why the economic crisis of the 1870s didn't set up a political failure for the socialist proletariat movement, and why, and I certainly don't know why the USSR developed into Stalinism, and in that moment, I think they would say socialism was sort of defeated. They don't explain that. And I feel like one of the reasons they don't explain that is because it means wading in on these historical problems that from previous eras and these old debates, which are still kind of being worked out, even in the Soviet Union, are being debated and fought over, because those were the ways in which people could communicate problems in the Soviet Union, was through the history of socialism. It means wading in on them from a perspective that they feel they're not able, where they're not able to do so. Like, we cannot resolve the revisionist crisis of 1895 in 2020, because the political situation is so different. So, but then the question is like, well, what do we do with that? With the understanding we have of that crisis or that problem, and what I would ask, and I don't think anyone in Platypus would ask, is what does our understanding of the fundamentals of, say, economy tell us about that? Is there any way in which, you know, understanding Marx's Capital Volume 1 going to help us in understanding 1895 or 1873, you know. I rewatched at double speed and sometimes skipping ahead the 2 hour and 44. Yeah. because I've, you know, I've listened to it all a few times, but I rewatched it and I wrote down some questions as it went along, and I want to just read you some of them here.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to answer them. Did the crisis deepen, meaning the proletariat struggle deepened between 1890 and 1914? What caused the regression? What defeated the proletariat political movement? Was it killed by the bourgeois or bourgeoisie? What causes a crisis of capitalism per Catron? Is it a cultural political crisis? Was the crisis in the 19th century the crisis of the boom?
Mm-hmm.
Was the Marxist revisionist problem, the crisis in Marxism, the crisis for capitalism, or was the crisis in 1870s, in the 1870s?
One of the most fascinating debates I can tell you about my own political education coming out of Platypus is I kind of alternated between antinomies myself, and antipodes to this. You know, I went into sort of like post-Bordigist endnotes world, but while also following the debates between Catron and Andrew Kleiman before they were so acrimonious over the Trump articles later.
Yeah.
When it was mainly a debate, but, you know, a relatively friendly debate, actually. Kleiman, you know, used to say good things about Platypus, believe it or not.
Yeah.
About the historical versus the economic role of Marxism. Conversely, the CPGB, which I like, and I do not think they are always politically reductionist or politically determinist. But when I read Matt Metnair's political strategy, while he makes peons to economic conditions, 99% of what he thinks determines, you know, the Soviet Union are political strategic questions, not economic or historical questions.
Mm-hmm.
And so Lenin's decisions Lenin's and the Second International's decisions are framed in terms of the impetus of, you know, trying to keep political groups together to create a class republic. However, I will say that McNair talks a lot more about class than generally is talked about in Platypus.
Catron says, after Hegel, philosophy had officially ended because for Hegel, he didn't think you needed a specialized realm of philosophy any longer, but rather society as a whole would become philosophical.
Right.
And I kind of imagine what that would mean from a socialist perspective. It would mean that the people of society would be aware of their own the conditions of their own possibility and were aware of their responsibility for them.
Which Hegel thought would emerge from the bourgeois world.
I mean, right, absolutely. From the bourgeois world. My cat's wanting into this shot now. So that would be what philosophy realized would be a society which was still revolutionary. This is, again, I'm really quoting Catron, because the philosophy would be worked out through social practice. So right. We would all become our own Socrates in a way, as we had control over our own conditions of possibility. Even now, that's quite utopian in a way, just stated that way. But then the idea was, since the revolution of 1848 didn't succeed, philosophy was reborn and the society became unphilosophical in that moment. He said, people needed philosophers the same reason they needed the state. No longer able to manage their own social relations, they needed the state to step in. No longer able to think, they needed people like Heidegger, he said.
Right. I mean, one of the things I remember being discussing with Catrone was that Heidegger was kind of the end of the second wave of philosophy in a sort of, you know, decadent phase where you become obsessed with your own being and the manifestation of that being.
Well, that certainly seems to be back, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, to which critical theory, you know, via Adorno emerges. That's, you know, like Adorno's move. The other parts of the Frankfurt School largely omitted from this. Horkheimer and Adorno's move are, you know, come out of debating later Heideggerians, you know, about the meaning of authenticity. And
but you're all ready to give a lot of the game away.
Right.
Take on their frame, right?
Right. And, you know, Hork, I think in your recent video on conservative Marxism, you know, that lovely oxymoron, and frankly, a lot of people accuse Platypus of conservative Marxism because of, I've heard people, you know, basically say it's a regression to bourgeois idealism. And other than the regression part, I'm not sure that Catrone would totally even have a problem.
I mean, Catrone probably would say maybe that's true, but I'd rather be Hegel than Locke.
Right. Although they would also tell me about Locke's, like, you know, I've had long debates with Spencer Leonard about what was great about Locke. Because I saw Locke as too contradictory to be a proper bourgeois revolutionary. but yeah, I mean, so, you know, in an exercise of reading this fairly, I do get frustrated because the terms are all quite vague. And you have to fill them in yourself. You also have this idea in basically kind of rarefied academic spaces, which is a lot of what EndNotes critiqued, Platypus for in 2013, removes this from the realm of working class action entirely. Because even a lot of these assertions are debates about the relationships of people who have access to the education to have these problems. And I've never heard that explained in terms of regression. Is that part of the regressive apparatus that the assumptions of Kowski and, Bernstein and maybe even not so much Engels, but of the First International, that the skilling required of labor would lead to more and more ability to have cross, you know, just general, the ending of rural idiocy, the development of the proletarian subject, to the point that they have the skills to engage in this and be, you know, but most people, even most academics, have a hard time with Heidegger, including in German. So what exactly, you know, who is the subject of this that now represents the entire social space?
It's the left. It's not the working class.
It's not even all the left. It's kind of the leadership and thought, you know,
the scholars,
luminaries. You get some of the activists, some professional revolutionaries, but I mean, it is in a way the vanguard of the vanguard to which this would apply, as if it is a stand-in for all of society. That was my critique of Platypus when I left. Now I have critiqued them before, and I've been in dialogue with members who said that I misunderstood their theory when I was in it. When I asked them particularly how, I didn't really get an answer. But when Catrone has talked to me about some of these things, I have gotten answers. So it's not that they're not, I don't think it's like a bad faith.
What kind of answers did Catrone give you?
They're often quite broad, but they are answers. Some of them is about, you know, the stalled out nature of the left. The left returned to questions which it's lost the context for. So if one of the things he talks about is Turley's misreading I actually don't entirely know that Turley's entirely misreading Lukács. I don't agree with his Althusserianism, but Turley's misreading of like Lukács's standpoint of the totality, for example, which is picked up in the 60s and 70s off of history and class consciousness as the foundation of standpoint epistemology, which we all like, but you know, the kind of hyper subjectivist epistemology that you see emerging out of New Left thinkers in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, they justify that off Lukács, and Cotron would say, well, that's because they lost Lukács's context of the stalling of the First and Second International. And so they don't understand that standpoint, which I think is true.
Yeah, but why? I mean, what is it that they fail to understand? That would be my main complaint about Cotron often enough, is that he'll say that and you realize it's true. It has to be true. But then, you know, what is it that Lukács understood that people who are looking at standpoint epistemology today or developing standpoint epistemology off of him today don't understand? I would have to say it has to do with the way in which capitalism socializes what was previously a much more private, individualized, atomized society. I know that we all think we're atomized today, and in many ways we are, and that's the contradiction of capitalism, but it does bring people together for mass production. Cross boundaries. So that was one thing that Lukács thought, was that and not just in that particular sense, but Lukács thought that capitalist relations themselves would determine the proletariat into a revolutionary subject, that it would give the proletariat a revolutionary subjectivity because of their standpoint within the totality of capitalism. It's not because anybody's standpoint is equally valid or that the what's real. I mean, first of all, the standpoint wasn't about determining truth either. It was about who will be the revolutionary and how will we bring everyone into a revolution.
It is not a factual epistemology. I hate talking about ontology in terms of Marxism because I think it's too abstract, but it is almost an ontology of the subject more than an epistemology of what is known. And
yeah, I mean, also, you say it that way, you're right, but I mean, the simple way is like, we're looking for people who might want to join our party.
Right.
You know, and we might want to overthrow the state and overturn the modes of production and change them.
What do we mean by philosophical questions? Because I tried to incorporate this into the presentation, but it just became too unwieldy. The presentation is too long to begin with. What do we mean by philosophical questions? Roughly speaking, and I'm not entirely sure of this, but this is what I came up with in terms of formulation. One could say the philosophical questions are concerned with ontology, epistemology, and living the good life. And essentially, I would say that Marxism is not about any of these. What I would aver, rather, is that starting with Kant and completed with Hegel, these are no longer the questions that are being asked. In other words, that Kant and Hegel are not asking epistemological, ontological, or good life questions. And so what are they asking? What questions are they asking? They're asking questions about the relation of theory and practice in bourgeois society. And of course, their view of bourgeois society is that it's a cosmological phenomenon that reaches back into history. In other words, that the possibility of this new form of freedom has always been there and it's always been developing in some way. And they're basically saying, look, in our relations to one another and in our everyday practices, what's the relationship between thinking and acting or theory and practice, and how do we grasp that? Right? In other words, that those questions are, in a sense, either beside the point or secondary. In other words, that those questions rely on another set of questions, and that, in a sense, we can only ask those questions now that we've emancipated ourselves. Living the good life today is serving the revolution. And so let me digress for a second. Rosa Luxemburg has a great phrase at the end of chapter 1 of the Genius pamphlet, The Crisis of German Social Democracy, in which she says, look, we could be like the Jews in the era of Moses that had to wander for 40 years in the desert, that they all had to die in order for the promised land to be found. That's the perspective. In other words, the perspective is that this generation of human beings living on the Earth right now, the best thing that we can do is struggle to overcome capitalism. There is no good life short of that. And it's a good life that we're not going to ourselves live. In other words, the emancipated future is not going to be ours. We are not going to live in a post-capitalist world. We are going to facilitate the bringing about of a post-capitalist world. And therefore, it's not for us to live the good life. It's for us to make the revolution.
Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books book club and help us to continue making online content from the left.